This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Intelligent design, evolution, and American politics. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is an archived edition of To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A federal judge has rejected intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in Pennsylvania's public schools. But many people still resist Charles Darwin's idea that complex organisms developed over millions of years by trial and error. On To the Point in August, we talked about intelligent design. Is it science or religion? Is it creationism under another name? The debate is bound to continue. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the theory of evolution applied, tongue-in-cheek, to the Democrats and their positions on the war in Iraq. First up, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Warren Olney back with an archived edition of To the Point. A federal judge has rejected intelligent design in public schools if it's labeled as an alternative to evolution. On To the Point, advocates still call it science. Is it really religious creationism by another name? On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, are the Democrats changing views on Iraq a test case of evolution in politics? First, this news update. It's been just a year since the tsunami hit Indonesia and other countries on the Indian Ocean, December 26, 2004. Dr. Susanna Hoffman is an anthropologist based in Colorado. She's author of Catastrophe and Culture, The Anthropology of Disaster. Dr. Hoffman, good to have you.
It's very nice to be with you.
You visited Banda Aceh 4 weeks after the tsunami. We all remember the physical devastation, so painful even in pictures that it was hard to look at. Who, though, were the most vulnerable people?
Oh, the most vulnerable people in the entire tsunami area, but particularly in Banda Aceh, were women.
Why is that?
There's a number of reasons. In every disaster, there's always a more vulnerable group that somehow society chooses, but it's often very hidden or very disguised, in this case, the women. The fundamental Muslim religion that the people in Banda Aceh have required that, and in the first place, it became, I think, quite fundamental as a resistance religion to Dutch colonization, which was quite harsh. So the women are in long skirts and sometimes double-layered, long sleeves, and very covered, they're just their faces showing in long headdresses. So they're weighed down to start with. Then, of course, they are in charge of the children. They are not allowed to swim, even though they're living by the ocean side, right along the water, and they're not taught to climb. So in these gowns and also without instruction, they're unable to go up trees or up houses. These factors all combined with the fact that 20 minutes earlier there was a violent earthquake, so they went home. They were taking care of children. And then on top of that, since they'd been so economically deprived since the colonization and since moving back to villages along the coast, when the ocean pulled back and they were uneducated as to what that meant, when the ocean pulled back, they saw dead fish and they saw free food, and they went into the ocean. On top of the fact that when the wave came in, they could barely run, they couldn't climb.
What a tragic story. Susanna Hoffman, again, author of Catastrophe and Culture. It's often said that natural disasters aren't really natural disasters at all. Is this, in some ways, an example of that?
Yes, it's very much so. All disasters are constructed, and they're constructed as processes over long periods of time, processes that the society goes through in and around its environment, or in technological disasters on the industry, perhaps, that they've allowed in. So this disaster was constructed in a number of ways. As I said, the colonization and the fact that when the people returned to coast from plantations, they didn't know their environment. They hadn't been educated in what the signs mean. Those villages that were truly indigenous knew what it meant, and they went uphill as soon as they saw the ocean pulled back. And then there's been a process around the world of coastalization, more and more people living on the coast everywhere, and particularly with tourism, say, in Thailand and Sri Lanka, where the tsunami was also terribly bad. People living on the coast for this industry or for a better life who didn't know what they were dealing with. So there's a number of years that build up to it, and then the choices of the society, in a sense, in the denial that society gets into as to how bad the risks are. Did they make a miscalculation, or are they perceiving the risks of their environment at all? So let's take Sumatra and Banda Aceh again. They've had tsunamis on a very regular basis. The fault line along the side of Sumatra is a very dangerous fault line, one of the worst kinds because it also produces volcanic material. And so there's been regular tsunamis, and yet there was a denial of the fact that they could happen.
We just have a minute left, and that's unfortunate because you have so many interesting things to say. But has there been recovery in Banda Aceh in the past year?
There's been some recovery, but it's very slow. People seem to think that recovery is very speedy after disasters. It's not, and I think we're going to see that now with Katrina and Rita. And in a country such as Sumatra, in India, Sri Lanka, even in Thailand, it's going to be slow, and we're going to have a process where survivors have been marginalized in society. They're living in camps. They're ghettoized, and that process is very slow to break. Returning to their villages and their homes, rebuilding, can be a very long-term process. There's many stages that survivors go through, the rise of new leaders, new political agendas, economic recovery that's difficult, hostility often with outsiders or with an agency that deals with them. There's a lot of steps that will still have to occur
okay.
before these people will recover.
Please come back. Talk to us again when we have more time.
We would love to
have you. Susanna Hoffman, anthropologist, author of Catastrophe and Culture, The Anthropology of Disaster. Thanks again.
Thank you.
In a moment, evolution, intelligent design, and American politics on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with an archived edition of To the Point. Asked about Darwin's theory of evolution, President Bush has said both sides ought to be properly taught. The question is, both sides of what? After more than 100 years of experiment and observation, mainstream scientists say that evolution is well established. The U.S. Supreme Court has outlawed teaching creationism because it's religion, not science. Since we first broadcast this program, a federal judge said the same thing about intelligent design. But the argument that some organisms are just too complex to be explained by evolution alone isn't going away. The intellectual background is being provided by the Discovery Institute, a conservative think tank in Seattle. Jody Wilgoren reports for the New York Times. Jody, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
You say in your story that when the president says both sides of the controversy ought to be taught properly, that sounds a lot like the Discovery Institute. Explain.
Well, the Discovery Institute, as you said, is the intellectual home for this movement known as intelligent design, and it has fellows who are doing research into that sort of fledgling theory and also into criticizing evolution. But its public policy approach, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years, has been not to push intelligent design, which is very controversial, but to push something called teach the controversy. And by that, they mean they want to teach evolution, but also the criticism of evolution. Now, as you said earlier, mainstream scientists don't think there is a controversy to be taught at all. They think evolution is well established. But by pushing this approach, Discovery has been able to enlist many more mainstream people into its cause who think that, you know, teaching a controversy sounds like a good idea. Both sides ought to properly be taught, as Bush said.
So, as you say in your story then, this becomes an issue of academic freedom, not a question of a confrontation between biology and religion.
Well, that's very much what the people at Discovery want it to be about.
Who funds the Discovery Institute?
It's a great variety of people, Warren. Discovery was founded in 1990 and only got into this evolution issue about 6 years later. The main funders of the intelligent design work are Christian foundations, many of whose mission is things like, you know, to evangelize the Bible. The main backer has been Howard and Roberta Amundson, the Orange County banking billionaires who are well known in California for funding right-wing and religious causes. But there are a lot of other people who give money to Discovery as well. One of the main funders of its transportation project is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They give $1 million a year to Discovery, not to fund the intelligent design work, but to fund a regional transportation initiative. And then there's others. Richard Mellon Scaife's Foundation gives money. There's a little tiny group called God's Gift in Temecula, California, that nobody really knows anything about. And a bunch of other people around the country.
So the Institute doesn't focus just on these questions of evolution. You say there's a transportation part of it, too. And yet in its founding paper, as I understand it, it says that its principal objective is to foster a broadly theistic, meaning religious, understanding of nature.
Well, there's two. It's a little confusing, Warren. The Discovery Institute, as I said, was founded in 1990, and it is a think tank that deals with many different issues. It has a transportation project, it has a technology project, it has fellows working on everything from animal rights to foreign affairs. Then in 1996 was founded something called the Center for Science and Culture. Actually, its original name was the Center for Renewal of Science and Culture, and they dropped that renewal later. But what you're reading from is something called the Wedge Document. The Discovery people say that that was just a fundraising document for the Center for Science and Culture. Others think of it as a much broader manifesto about that center's mission. And that document definitely did say that they were trying to, you know, overthrow a culture of materialism in favor of, as you said, a broadly theistic understanding.
Back to the political impact of the Discovery Institute. You say there have been something like 78 arguments about this in 31 states. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, they really range, Warren. There are about a dozen states where people have introduced legislation that would either require intelligent design to be taught or require some kind of criticism of evolution or something else. Then there are some things happening in local school districts. As you probably remember, there's a lawsuit in Cobb County, Georgia, where the school board had decided to put stickers on its textbooks saying evolution is only a theory. And the ACLU and parents have sued there. In Kansas, the state school board is rewriting its science standards that would require, as I said, criticism of evolution to be taught, really following Discovery's Teach the Controversy approach directly. And there are other things. There was a zoo down in Tulsa where there was a creationism exhibit was approved, although that got withdrawn later. There are museums.
Well, that wouldn't have anything to do with intelligent design if it's a creationism exhibit, though, would it?
No, but it's the numbers that you quoted, the 78 skirmishes, really include any kind of incident where evolution is being challenged at any level.
But the Discovery Institute isn't necessarily involved in all of those.
No, not at all. No. And what I said in my story is that they are the kind of ideological and strategic backbone of the kind of latest incarnation of the challenge to evolution. And they are, but they don't you know, pull all the strings directly. There clearly are parents and teachers and school board members and state legislators who are acting alone, and in many cases to the Discovery's great dismay. One of the things that they are very frustrated with is that a lot of people are pushing beyond where they feel ready to go, pushing to mandate the teaching of intelligent design in schools, which is something that they do not support.
Okay, Jody, we'll go on with the New York Times. We'll hear a little later from one of the scientists, biochemist at the Discovery Institute. In the meantime, I want to introduce a politician very much involved in this controversy. He is Senator Michael Fair, a Republican from Greenville, South Carolina, filed a bill in that state in June of this year requiring schools to expose students to a variety of theories on controversial issues. Senator Fair, thanks for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
We're glad to have you. You, as I understand it, are in fact a conservative Christian. You are a creationist. But your bill doesn't say anything about religion at all. It says that a new law that should be passed that requires that when there are controversial subjects, including biological evolution, then the full range of scientific views should be taught. What does that mean?
Well, not surprisingly, when Senator from Pennsylvania, Senator Santorum, offer his sense of the Senate amendment to No Child Left Behind legislation in Washington. I guess that was 3-4 years ago. The language that he offered that was supported, incidentally, by voice vote there in the U.S. Senate. His amendment was to become part of the conference committee report on No Child. And that language is essentially the language that I use, which does and says several things. But basically, you've already talked about it. It encourages a complete handling, a complete and thorough discussion of biological evolution. And it also suggests that there needs to be parameters for the way that controversial issues are handled in the public school classroom. This will have the effect, I think, of freeing up scientific inquiry in the classroom. And in South Carolina, it will allow teachers to pursue the best practices as far as teaching and the best curriculum as far as science education.
So this then would mean that in science class, there would have to be taught that there is scientific disagreement about evolution. Is that correct?
Well, it doesn't mandate that force an imposed kind of circumstance that the teacher must trump up opposition to accepted types of evolution that is observable under a microscope. In fact, my legislation allows the State Board of Education to first to implement the policy. So the mandate is to the State Board to develop the policy. It gives them a great deal of flexibility and freedom to set up those parameters. It does also gives a guarantee on that there would be a quality science education. That, again, is in keeping with the Santorum Amendment. It reaffirms something that I, as a youngster, was taught about science, and that is the empirical method. It reaffirms that empiricism is part of science and with a focus on testable theories. That's language right out of the bill. And it encourages the curriculum to make a distinction, and this is perhaps the area that's got some Darwinists upset, because it encourages the classroom teacher to make a distinction between science and religion, or religious claims or philosophical claims. And that apparently is new business for a lot of people. Clearly, this legislation, at least it's clear to me, doesn't veer off the accepted path, the strange legal environment we've been in for a number of years now. And it's right in the center lane on the appropriate legal environment.
Okay, let me ask you this, Senator Fair. There are those who contend that since the Supreme Court has ruled that you can't teach creationism as science, because in fact it's religion, that the kind of legislation you're proposing is a way to get around that constitutional ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that right?
Well, if it makes it around, that's yet to be determined, isn't it? I don't see anything religious, frankly. The argument about intelligent design conjures up interesting pictures of houses being nailed together by architecture and so forth. Is that religious? But this, in fact, goes in the other direction. I think that's what has created a controversy in and of itself between scientists, and that is, it says clearly, religion is different, philosophy is different. It must be taught differently, if taught at all, and you must distinguish between that. Let me tell you one of the things going on in South Carolina that illustrates the need for this kind of legislation. We were given a draft on one of our education committees, a draft of science standards, changes in science standards. B5.5 is a draft on point. It says this, it's very short: exemplify science evidence in the fields of anatomy, embryology, biochemistry, and paleontology that supports the theory of biological evolution. Well, that is not education. That's indoctrination. And perhaps it's indoctrination coming from someone's worldview that is at least philosophical. That's the kind of thing we're trying to stop.
Okay. Senator Michael Fair, state senator in South Carolina, comes from Greenville, has in fact proposed the legislation that he has described. Nick Matzke is a spokesperson for the National Center for Science Education. That's a nonprofit research group tracking the evolution creationism controversy, one that was set up to do that. Nick Matzke, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What about intelligent design, and what about the senator's legislation? He says it's not really with has no religious language in it, and it is not religious in intent.
Well, I think it's great you had Senator Fair on there because he perfectly represents the evolution in creationism that we've seen over the past few years. Back in 2003, Senator Fair was endorsing intelligent design straight up. He thought that that should be taught. Earlier this year in 2005, he had a bill that recommended that, quote, alternative theories be taught. And now he's finally sort of gotten the memo from the Discovery Institute, which does actively go out and tell sort of their supporters to calm down and take a much more subtle strategy, which is that Santorum language that he mentioned, which sort of portrays evolution as controversial. That's really the whole goal. The whole goal is to sort of raise illegitimate doubts about evolution. He thinks that simply saying that the evidence supports evolution is indoctrination, but that's the scientific mainstream, and it's no more controversial than saying the evidence supports, for example, plate tectonics, which it does, or Einstein's theory of relativity, which it does, or atomic theory. You know, saying that those are well supported by evidence is not indoctrination. That is what the scientists say, and that is the opinion of the scientific community.
Well, science, though, as I understand it, is devoted in part to proving that things are wrong as well as proving that things are right. Are you saying there's absolutely no scientific controversy whatsoever about evolution?
Oh, well, no is a really strong word. But if you poll scientists, you will not get a very large percentage that have any agreement with intelligent design or these other concepts. And, in fact, most scientists are vehemently opposed. It's over 100-1. The Discovery Institute, they have a list of scientists that they say doubt Darwin. And what they did was assemble a very, very vague statement saying that, maybe some aspects of Darwinism should be questioned. And they've got 400 names on that list. It's kind of a test of that. Our group, NCSE, made a list of scientists who support a very strong pro-evolution statement, except to qualify for this list, you had to have the first name of Steve or Stephanie, which represents, only about 1% of people have the first name of Steve. And that list has over 500 scientists on it. So that sort of gives you some idea. If you look at the number of Steves on the Discovery Institute list, they have 4. So, that gives you some idea of where the scientific community is at on this issue.
Nick Matzke, again, spokesperson for the National Center for Science Education. We are going to come back and continue this conversation. We'll speak with Michael Behe, who is a biochemist at the University of, at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He is also a member of the Discovery Institute. We'll talk also with another scientist. And on Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the theory of evolution applied, tongue-in-cheek, to the Democrats and their posturing on the war in Iraq on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about evolution and intelligent design. We've talked a lot about the political ramifications of the dispute about these two ideas. Let's talk now a bit about the science. Michael Behe is a biochemist at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He's author of Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. He's also a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, which we've heard about before. That's the think tank in Seattle that is advocating intelligent design. Michael Behe, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, nice to be with you.
You are skeptical about evolution as a scientist. Why?
Well, because the critical point of is not evolution or not even common ancestry. The critical point that Darwin claimed to have solved was how could such phenomenal complexity and elegance and sophistication in life have arisen by a natural process? And his
His answer, of course, was that maybe it was random variation and natural selection, that some organism happened to be born with some alteration, mutation, we would say today, which gave it a little bit of an advantage, and therefore it left more offspring if the offspring inherited that advantage and spread throughout the population. But if you look at much of biology, and in particular the elegant and sophisticated molecular machinery that has been discovered at the very foundation of life in the past half century, there is very good reasons to doubt that it could be put together by that very gradual, tiny step by tiny step process that Darwin envisioned. And I have suggested rather that if you look at this machinery, just like looking at machinery in everyday life, just as if you look at a machine like, say, an outboard motor, you would conclude that it was designed. Well, there are outboard motors in cells, too, and lots of other molecular machinery, little trucks and buses running around your cells. And so the argument is pretty straightforward that whenever we see complex functional machinery, we realize that it was designed, and now we found it in the cell, and the argument is that we're rational in concluding that that was designed as well.
You are, as I understand it, a practicing Catholic. What role do your religious beliefs play in your conclusions?
Well, in my conclusions, my religious beliefs play absolutely no role whatsoever. It turns out I was taught Darwinian evolution in parochial school. I'm certainly Catholic, have been all my life. But we were always taught that if God wanted to make life by the outplaying of natural laws, then, well, who were we to tell him otherwise? And that always sounded convincing to me. I was happy to accept Darwin's explanation. It was only when I was an associate professor here at Lehigh and started, for various reasons, to think more closely about evolution that I became skeptical.
Do you buy the idea of Darwinian evolution on a larger scale? In other words, the giraffe whose neck is long got that way after trial and error with lots of giraffes whose necks didn't grow falling away, and those who did surviving because they were able to reach the food.
Let me make it clear that, sure, I do think that Darwinian explanations can account for some things. Exactly how much, I think, remains a very open question. I'm a biochemist. I stick with molecules and cells and so on, and there at the foundation of life is where I'm pretty skeptical. But let me just point out that the account of giraffe necks and so on is what I see as a manifestation of the big problems with Darwinism. That is, you know, that what you read in the literature is not a whole heck of a lot more detailed than the little story that you just recited, which every kid hears about in biology class, and which are ridiculed in many meetings of evolutionary biologists as just so stories, you know, these simple-minded evidence-challenged stories about how life developed.
Okay, Michael Behe, again, biochemist at Lehigh University, senior fellow of the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Lynn Caporelli is a biochemist also and previously professor of biochemistry at Georgetown University Medical School. She also taught genetics at Columbia, and she's author of Darwin in the Genome, Molecular Strategies in Biological Evolution. Lynn Caporelli, welcome to you.
Welcome.
You obviously are dealing with the same kind of science that Michael Behe is. Are you, in the same way that he is, skeptical about Darwinian evolution?
No, not at all. I think it's really interesting, in fact, that one of the examples that he gives as a biochemist, the blood coagulation system as being irreducibly complex, he's called it, is the very system that I was studying when I began to be intrigued by the question of evolution. But I want to back up a second and just say what Darwin said, because I think if we're going to talk about evolution, we shouldn't say that the dispute isn't about evolution or common ancestry. What I taught, for example, in genetics is what's standard is taught and what Darwin initially said, and that is that there is variation in a population, and we can see that in the human population. He could see it in beetles and so on, and that that variation is inherited. He didn't know how, but that some of the variants would be in some way fit and would tend to survive. And what the history of biology has been through the intervening 150 years is deepening and deepening and deepening our understanding at the molecular level now of Darwin's framework. So far from, I mean, he didn't know about genes. He didn't know about DNA. He certainly never saw a genome sequence. So there have been many opportunities in our advancing science to knock Darwin off his pedestal. But in fact, the impression that most of us have is that we understand it at a much deeper level. So we now understand how information from the structure of DNA, how information can be transferred between generations, and how variation develops through mutations. Now, when you come to these complicated systems that you see today around us, such as blood coagulation, if you we're now in a position, and this is an exciting moment in intellectual history, because of all the genome projects, because of high throughput technology, because of the influx of people trained with computer science and mathematics into analyzing these large data sets, we are now in a position to see how the little bits and pieces of these machines have traveled through all the history of life, through other forms of being, in the sense that, of course, we know we share DNA with bacteria, and so we need to make the pieces of DNA and so on. The proteins that are involved in our blood coagulation system are related to proteins that are found in other life forms. So there's a lot of this is the moment to be actually asking these questions. We finally have the tools to ask, and we don't know every answer about every protein evolved, but there is no reason to say that I can't figure this out. In fact, this is the very moment to figure it out.
So I'm sorry, I think you're getting a bit beyond our audience when you talk about blood coagulation and so on and into the controversy in a very detailed way. But if I can go back to what Michael Behe said, it was this, that the complexity, elegance, and sophistication of what we see at the molecular level, he says, just simply couldn't have come about by random selection. There must have been some intelligent designer. Why don't you believe that?
No, I can see pathways. I mean, these are hypotheses, but there's no reason to give up, throw up our hands. I can definitely see pathways through which these systems have evolved. And in fact, at the DNA level, you can see high relationships between proteins that we have and proteins in other life forms. And so there is really just no reason to hypothesize the involvement of a intelligent designer. And, you know, some people, just to bring in the controversy about religion, some people actually think this is more beautiful, that all of this diversity was imminent in the first forms of life on Earth, and that evolution is a process of unfolding. So we're not battling, trying to set up a battle. It's just that the evidence points in this direction.
Well, if the plan was incipient there from the very beginning, can we know then that there must have been some original designer?
No, that I'm just saying it's not inconsistent. You know, science can't prove or disprove faith. That's a separate issue. But what we can say is we have a process through variation followed by selection with inheritance of the variation that can take us stepwise from simple forms of life to complex forms. And at this very moment in history, we actually have picked up the hood on the diversity, looked under the hood, and we can see, and it's actually beautiful, the deep connections between all life on Earth, the deep biochemical connections.
Lynn Caporelli, biochemist, previously at Georgetown and Columbia. Let me go back to Michael Behe, also biochemist at Lehigh University. The phrase irreducibly complex was introduced by Lynn Caporelli. That's a phrase I gather that comes from you. And you're saying, as you did earlier, that all these steps involving processes couldn't have taken place without there having been a design. She says that we're on the verge of figuring out the design.
Well, I think she's more optimistic there than I am. Let me just explain the irreducibly complex for the listeners a bit. I use in my book an example of irreducible complexity from our everyday life, and that's a mouse trap. A mechanical mouse trap you buy at the store has a number of parts, like a spring and a bar called a hammer and a wooden platform and a couple others. And if one of those parts is taken away, the mouse trap is broken. And the relevance is that there are many things in the cell which are much like that which need a number of different parts in order to work. And it's extremely difficult to see how such things could be put together by the tiny undirected steps, even with natural selection, that Darwin envisioned. And if you look at the science literature, there are no such explanations out there. And it's clearly true, like Professor Caporal, that a lot of Darwinists say they can see pathways, but in my view, they're seeing things that aren't there. There are no experiments that show they can happen. If you poke their stories, it's like the story of the giraffe's neck getting longer that you recited a little while ago. They do not stand up well to skepticism, but there's very few skeptics out there.
Can there be an experiment that would demonstrate that there was, in fact, intelligent design?
Well, I don't think you can demonstrate intelligent design by an experiment. You know, think of something like Mount Rushmore.
Well, isn't that what you need to do for science?
No. I mean, can you demonstrate there was a Big Bang by experiment? Of course not. That we infer that event from the effects of what happened a long, long time ago. And with design, it's kind of the same way. You infer design from the effects of that design. And my example of Mount Rushmore, you know, you can't do an experiment to show that Mount Rushmore was designed, but anybody looking at it, even if you've never heard of it before, can perceive the design simply because it's a complex functional system.
Michael Behe, we're at Lehigh University and the Discovery Institute. Back to Lynn Caporelli, formerly at Georgetown and Columbia. What about the mousetrap and Mount Rushmore?
Okay, let's start with the mousetrap. Well, the pieces of the mousetrap do have other functions. In other words, the person who made the first mousetrap didn't invent metal, didn't invent springs, didn't, you know, and so the same sort of thing is happening through evolution. Now Michael might say, well, this is a just-so story because we haven't proved every single use for every single blood clotting protein. But I can say, for example, that we can see in other forms of life that existed a long time ago, that many of the proteins involved in this system were involved in, and it was a smaller system, involved in clotting a fluid that isn't blood, but that, say, a horseshoe crab has in it in response to infection. And so two systems that eventually diverged, and we have in our blood to fight infection, the complement system, and to fight and to clot our blood, you can see a path for how they could have come from the clotting of the horseshoe crab hemolymph. So it's not there's no wall we've come up against. That's the issue. There's nothing that has to be designed.
Michael Behe, he says that you're seeing patterns and pathways that he doesn't think are there.
Well, the question is, science comes from hypothesis testing. So just by seeing something and saying, gee, I can't figure it out, how this could have happened, well, you can't reject the people who are coming up with hypotheses that then can be investigated. And in fact, there have been testable hypotheses in the sense of seeing the effects of something that's happened before. As he talks about figuring out that the Big Bang happened by the background noise that we hear and the microwave radiation. So you can say that I predict that I'm going to find another protein here that looks like this protein, and people do find that. And that's the process of science, and it's continuing.
So let me go back to Michael Behe on that point then. Are you, in fact, giving up too soon?
Well, I don't think so. The immensity the sophistication of cells, I think, to somebody who doesn't feel committed to Darwin's theory, is I think pretty persuasive. But let me just say that oftentimes it's a judgment call. For example, you know, when the Big Bang Theory was first introduced in physics in the earlier part of the 20th century, a lot of people didn't like that because it seemed to point beyond the universe. It seemed to even to suggest some supernatural origin. A lot of scientists were against that. And some stuck with the steady state theory, the unchanging eternal universe that was popular at that time. Other people thought that the data could be better explained by the Big Bang. I think an analogy can be drawn to intelligent design. I think the data are much better explained by postulating intelligent design.
Okay. We are out of time. Michael Behe, quickly, if you will. Should the controversy that you're talking about be taught as science?
I think it should be discussed in science class so that students get a good idea of the state of our knowledge.
Lynn Caporelli, your answer to that same question.
Not in science class. I think it belongs in the political science discussion of the interaction of lay, you know, people with science over the course of history from Galileo and so on. There are so many interesting ideas floating around in science. There isn't time to teach them all. We could use more time for science education because there's so much work to be done from curing diseases and so on. So.
All right, a controversy that is bound to continue for some time to come. As we heard earlier, there's something like 78 controversies going on about it at state legislatures, school boards, and other such places. So it is both political as well as scientific. We'll try to keep our listeners up to date. Thank you all for being with us today. Lynn Caporelli, biochemist, Georgetown, Columbia, author of Darwin in the Genome, Molecular Strategies and Biological Evolution. Michael Behe at Lehigh University, author of Darwin Black Box, the Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. Thanks also to our earlier guest, Nick Matzey of the National Center for Science Education, to State Senator Michael Fair of South Carolina, and to Jody Wilgoren of the New York Times. Just last week, a federal judge rejected intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in Pennsylvania's public schools. But evolution applies to more than just biological science. It's a useful metaphor for many types of development. In a moment, we'll explore how it applies to political change in Washington on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
This is Werman Alney with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The family of Democrats once consisted of two basic types of politicians, those who supported the war in Iraq and those who opposed it. But as the war has dragged on, new species of Democrats have evolved, morphing and grouping on op-ed pages in think tanks and on Sunday morning talk shows. That's according to Michael Crowley, congressional reporter and senior editor for the New Republic magazine. In a recent issue, he wrote a zoological guide to Democrats on Iraq. Michael, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Tell us about some of these families of Democrats.
Well, yeah, we felt like Democrats were beginning to look like a sort of Galapagos island of all these fascinating varied species, and sometimes it can be hard to keep track of where everyone stands. So the idea was to try to categorize them with tongue planted in cheek to some extent, but also trying to be accurate. So we have these came up with some of these different categories that we can walk through if you like.
Well, let's start with the Rapidus Exodus.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, I haven't heard from any biologists yet complaining, and I think we have the sort of categories in the language right here. So I think we would call this the genus, which encompasses a couple of species. The Rapidus Exodus, generally speaking, are Democrats who want to get out of Iraq quickly, and that is really the vast majority of the Democratic Party, as most of your listeners will know. But within this genus, I identified two species, and the most common I've dubbed the Dovis withdrawalis, also known as the told-you-so Democrats. These are Democratic doves who opposed the war initially and generally are mistrustful of U.S. military power abroad. And basically, these are people in often found in sort of the House of Representatives, liberals in the House, people, for instance, like Dennis Kucinich would qualify, and many other members of what is known as the Out of Iraq Caucus in the House, which is actually a real caucus. That's not my terminology there. There are about 70 Democrats who have formed this group. The other species within this category I call the caucus withdrawalists, and these are Democratic hawks who are known as what people often say in Washington as pro-military. And these people supported the war in Iraq and have sort of a reputation for being kind of tough, but feel like the war has ground down the military and are sort of appalled by what it's doing to the troops. And, of course, the real face of this species would be Jack Murtha, who gave that very famous speech back in November saying that it was time for the U.S. to get out of Iraq very quickly and that our military options, that our ability to do good there with the military had pretty much been played out.
So these two species are in the same genus. They
yeah.
sound different, but you also point out that in some cases one hides behind the other.
Well, yes. So, you know, if you sort of imagine them in the wild, they have a little bit of a symbiotic relationship. It's particularly beneficial for the dovish withdrawalists because these dovish Democrats are often identified as being sort of anti-military or pacifist. Now, you know, that's usually not really a fair way to say it, but they will be attacked by Republicans for seeming that way. But they are delighted at the evolutionary development of the hawkish withdrawalists, because the best thing that ever happened to someone like Dennis Kucinich or even Nancy Pelosi, the House Democratic leader, is the emergence of a hawkish withdrawalist like Jack Murtha. In other words, a decorated military veteran identified as being a pro-military guy who is saying, you know what, we have to get out as soon as practically possible.
We're talking with Michael Crowley, who's written A Zoological Guide to Democrats on Iraq for the New Republic magazine. You know, one of the words I love to apply whenever I possibly can to politicians is bloviator, and you have a wonderful genus that includes that word. Tell us about it.
This is the Bloviatus gradual morph. And the colloquial term for these may be the cut-and-stay Democrats. So the gradual morph applies to this idea of, cut-and-stay as opposed to cut-and-run, which is the pejorative term that the Bush administration often uses to describe people who want to get out quickly. Cut-and-stay describes Democrats who want to reduce troop levels but are not do not believe that we need to get all the troops out right away. They want to see a gradual reduction but generally feel it would be irresponsible to flee immediately. So hence the gradual morph. Bloviatus was a perhaps slightly gratuitous addition to the phrase, which describe the fact that this type of Democrat likes to generally give very sort of long-winded, portentous policy speeches in important forums like the Council on Foreign Relations or various colleges and universities, which often take a very long time to get to, you know, a fairly simple point, which is that in many cases they say, we can't just declare that we're leaving by a certain deadline, however they believe it's important to send the message that we are beginning to reduce our presence and to let the Iraqis know that there will be a time in the not-too-distant future when American troops will no longer be there.
Well, it's a very creative way also to call politicians bloviators, and I want to congratulate you for that. I think it was a very good idea.
Oh, thank you.
You have a lot of other various categories within the genus and in addition to the genus, but tell us about one species that Joe Lieberman fits into. That's an interesting one, too.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Joe Lieberman actually, we created a species all his own. It is the Fidelis purus, and the idea is total maximum fidelity to the cause. And from what our research can determine, he may be the last remaining member of this species, a Democrat who supported the war more or less unequivocally back in 2002 and 2003, and who now really has almost no difference with the Bush administration's policies at this point. Lieberman believes that our troops have to stay in Iraq for the long haul. He supports some drawdowns, but is as devoted to maintaining a troop presence and trying to stabilize the country as the Bush White House is. And he has shown a sort of fascinating evolutionary resilience, seemingly, an indestructible creature who can't be swayed by politics or events, much to the dismay of his fellow Democrats.
And all of these creatures struggling against one another, the Rapidus Exodus, the Dovis Withdrawalists, the Bloviators, I need to look that one up because I can't remember it, and the Fidelis Purists have one existential enemy that they have to worry about, and who's that?
That's great. That's right. Well, this is, you know, the great sort of dragon that roams their world and you know, threatens to destroy them at any time. This is the Dubiosaurus. Until Democrats can find some way of agreeing with one another and finding common cause and kind of bringing all their species together and unifying, I think the Dubiosaurus will reign supreme and will have them sort of on the run. So that's the existential problem that the Democrats face today.
And there it is. And you don't have to go to the Galapagos Island. All you have to do is visit Capitol Hill to find all of these extraordinary creatures evolving before our eyes. Although, as you say, you can also look at the op-ed pages, the various universities and other institutions, think tanks as well. Michael Crowley, good to have you with us. And thanks for your scientific view of what's happening on Capitol Hill.
Thank you so much, Warren.
Michael Crowley, congressional reporter, senior editor for The New Republic magazine. Today's program produced by Karen Radziner, Kristen Bordahl, and Francis Anderton. Our technical director is John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.